related to entanglement. And that should take us through about 10:45, we'll have a break. And then we have Tony Leggett coming to give a presentation and question and answer period. So, where we go. So far we looked at the double slit experiment. Various ways, you have the wall, you can do particles, tennis balls. With waterways, basically a wall, two holes in it, some wave coming through, you get diffractions and mainly interference patterns. And also it was done with electrons, there was sort of a video with the electrons. And the strange thing is actually saw the probability pattern distribution of electrons was exactly the same as the interference pattern. Even though they actually had the flux of the electrons going, basically so few electrons going through that it was just one electron after another. So something, the interference at the level of individual electrons. So, we found out that it just wasn't electrons. In theory anyway, quantum physics says that exactly the same behavior in principle you could get with any object. It's just a matter of the scale, depending on how massive the object is, what its momentum is, what its weight, lengths are, and in terms of seeing the real experiment, how technically difficult that might be. Then we saw the wave particle duality, a key concept in quantum theory, and superposition. And I think we got up to... Okay, we saw the video, fine. So, we're looking at this idea, this modification of the double slit experiment, where, okay, let's have a look at the slits, and there's some cameras there, just some kind of detectors. Just very, very sensitive to the electric fields, the electrons going through. So again, we're looking at the double slit experiment with electrons, where there's some kind of electron gun, a really hot filament, and it's just firing out electrons here, and they're going along. And we want to sort of take a peek and find out, sort of, you know, there are thousands of electrons going through it. Say number 467. Is that going through this slit 2 or this slit 1 here? And we saw, so if we actually think about it, so the electron 467, can we actually predict? Can we predict? You know, this is science. You know, sure, it's all about prediction. It's about determinism. It's about sort of uniformity of the world. Can we actually predict whether it will go through slit 1 or 2 in an individual electron? And quantum physics says, at least this is the major interpretation. Hans Westman gave his presentation, talked a little bit about deterministic theories of quantum physics. And so as you know, I mean, this is science, so there's sort of a lot of layers and there's some uncertainty. And there are some details, but I won't sort of be going into. We talked about the Bohm interpretation, Bohmian mechanics, and so forth. And so it's possible to have a deterministic view, and sort of minority of physicists take that. But really, I guess I'll be presenting the party line today, because just so as not to overcomplicate things too much. But it's not absolutely black and white. But this is certainly the mainstream standard way of interpreting quantum physics. So, what it says is it's actually impossible to predict. There's sort of no way, no matter how carefully you actually watch, you set up the experiment, whether that electron or any other electron indeed goes through one slit or the other one. And it's actually a genuinely random event, 50-50 probability. And another example is Schrodinger's cat. So Schrodinger's cat, you have this box. Okay. Thank you. I want to ask. So you have a box there, some sort of radioactive substance, could be uranium, for example, and within an hour, it's just set up so that it has actually a 50-50 chance of having some radioactive decay there. You have a Geiger counter. Right next to it. And what happens if that Geiger counter picks up a radioactive decay event, the radioactive uranium decays, then that basically, so do the politically correct version or the original version. Okay, so I'll do the original version. So the original, we updated it, so I'll give you both versions. So the original version is that this was actually linked up to a vial of, I forget the type of acid, it was
cyanide.
Cyanide, okay, yep. here, and what happens, there was a hammer or something, and it broke the hammer broke the vial of cyanide, and that sort of basically leaked in, and the cat kind of went from this to like that, so the cat died. So that would happen if it was a red apple case. This chain of events breaks the acid, or the cyanide kills the cat. But radioactive decay is this probabilistic thing, and there's a 50% chance that it did not happen, so this sort of sequence of events wouldn't happen. And so according to quantum physics, what it seems to be happening is, well, one way of looking at it, the way Schrodinger looked at it, was that basically, and this is a microscopic event, you've got some just tiny atoms here. And so quantum physics doesn't tell you that it definitely happens or it definitely does. It just gives you this kind of superposition. Both possibilities realized at once. As we looked at the superposition states yesterday, and Hans Westman talked about that. And so if you just follow the mathematics of quantum theory, well, if this is in a superposition, the atom is in a superposition of decayed or not decayed, then, well, it's linked up to the Geiger counter. So if the atom is in a superposition, and the Geiger counter is kind of taking its lead, if you like, from the atom, then, well, it must be in a superposition, or a sort of an indeterminate state, both having sort of registered account and not registered account. But then the cyanide, the acid, is linked to the Geiger counter. So if it's in a superposition, it's in an indeterminate state, then this must be true. And if this is, then so is the cat is, and so on and so forth. So one very natural way of looking at it is to say that actually at the end of 1 hour, there's this feline that isn't in a superposition or an indeterminate state of actually being both dead and alive. And that obviously, we never see cats in sort of these weird, indeterminate, fuzzy states. And so quantum physics says, or at least one natural interpretation of it, is what happens when we actually open the box and look at the end of the hour, that actually collapses the wave function, or somehow kind of disrupts this very sensitive, fragile state, and actually, with a 50% chance, cause it to kind of collapse or go to this dead cat state, and 50% chance the other cat be alive. Happy cat. So, and it also says importantly that you cannot predict which outcome will occur. Like it's a genuine coin toss or rolling a die. It's fundamentally unpredictable. And so that's basically an analogy. So it's exactly the same thing as the electron, each individual electron going through one slit. And so that's the original version. You go the paper Die Nature, Wissenschaften. My German is very bad, 1935. But the politically correct version now is it's just something that puts the cat to sleep instead of... Because for a while, I think people that theoretical physicists were people that killed cats, tortured cats. But that's just a malicious rumor. It's not true. Very nice people. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so that's the example. And a more familiar example, I mean, a lot of people have smoke detectors that have americium in them, and it's a radioactive substances, and so you actually get radioactive decay events. A lot of people have them in their homes, and fundamentally, quantum physics says that they are random. Although, having said, if you have a large sample, I mean, it's not completely random, and you can get no prediction whatsoever. If you have a large number of quantum particles, so americium, you might have millions and millions and millions, probably the order of Avogadro's number of sort of americium particles in your smoke detector, however many you have. Even though if you pick out an individual one, you can't tell whether that will decay or not. Just it has certain probability of doing that. So you can figure out at the end of an hour, a certain fraction of decay and get sort of probability calls. Just as if I have one six-sided die here, I roll that, you can't predict whether it will roll one, two, or three. But if you have 1,000 of them lined up, you roll all of them, pretty much it's likely 1/6 of them will be one, 1/6, two, etc. Just through the statistics. And I guess the law of large numbers, you can get some predictability. And so this sort of genuine randomness is a core feature of quantum theory. Again, you can do the double slit experiment with photons. Exactly the same thing would apply with neutrons, with protons, and in principle, in buckyballs, whatever. And you always find this sort of genuine randomness. Just fundamentally, the world is random. And if you're actually just going back to a technical point, we looked at psi, the wave function, before the other day, and we looked at that with sort of like a probability field or a probability amplitude field. And that was sort of connected to, that was what gave us sort of these patterns we saw the previous day here. So this is sort of kind of, if you like, it's kind of, it's hard to, I'm not sure if the perspective came out right, but this is kind of, in a sense, meant to be, so we, this is sort of meant to be a vertical wall here. So I guess in a sense we're looking from the top down at this wall. So we're sort of above, from a bird's eye view, we're looking sort of down here. And if we actually look along this wall, just how many electrons hit along this wall, we'll get, and we sort of plot that on, I guess, a graph of probability on the y-axis, and the x-axis just the distance along this wall here, we'll get a probability plot like this. And so what that corresponds to is essentially the square of this probability field, or probability amplitude field, if you want to get technical, the wave function. And so what gives you the probabilities? It's this psi field, which is analogous to just a water field that actually gives you the probabilities. So this is the mathematical tool we use to calculate, you know, how likely it is for electricity to be there, at other places. Okay, and so interesting enough, so someone mentioned quantum cryptography. Actually, has anyone, who's heard of quantum cryptography before? Okay, great. So you will actually be getting to see quantum cryptography lab this afternoon at Institute of Quantum Computing. And I'll talk a bit about it to explain what it involves. But it's strange. This feature, this genuine randomness, actually has practical applications. And one of those is, you can actually, today you can buy, for another few companies around the world, about half a dozen actually commercially available quantum random number generators that generate genuine random numbers. I mean, you have computers and algorithms that generate what they call pseudo-random numbers, basically, that take in some sort of huge number, for example, and generate what is apparently, you know, a random stream of numbers of zeros and ones or whatever. But ultimately, if it's an ordinary computer, in that sort of act, it's not actually at the quantum level. And so, in principle, in theory, you could actually predict what the kind of stream or sequence of random numbers would be. It would be just horrendously complicated, and, you know, it's impossible practically to do that. But in principle, you can. And so, you know, in principle, when you go to the casino and you're playing roulette, but if you actually knew everything, you know, in detail, exactly how, you know, how, what velocity or energy you gave the little roulette ball on the table was given, exactly what angle it went at, and so forth, all the little details, the temperature of the room, exactly all the air molecules and so forth in the room, how they were moving, colliding with the ball, then you could predict whether the roulette ball would go down and rest at number 3, 4, 5, whatever, and actually determine that win every time. But if you get down to the quantum level, then that's impossible. And so people have actually, there's a company, if you're interested in looking to buy one, that's the photo of one. And you can actually buy, so it's ID Quantique, it's in Geneva in Switzerland. It's the web address there. If you look at the advertisement, it's like, so it's when random numbers cannot be left to chance. And uses include gambling and lotteries. So that's how they're marketing. So I think that's a very appropriate use for quantum mechanics, the use of intellectual achievement and so forth. And it also ties up with quantum cryptography, which I think I'll talk a little bit more about later, but again, you'll get an introduction and talk with that. And essentially what quantum cryptography is it's tied up with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but it's secret codes that actually work at the individual quantum level. And in some sense, sort of exploit this sort of genuine fundamental randomness to actually make, in theory at least, 100% secure, absolutely secret codes. More of that a little bit later. Okay, so one interesting thing about this actually raises a number of sort of deep philosophical issues and its deep philosophical consequences. And I think it's very natural to ask, how can that actually be? How can that actually occur? I think it's very hard to get everyone's head around something just happening for no reason whatsoever. If we were watching the front of this room and a rabbit suddenly appeared on the table, it would be very natural to think, well, there must be some reason why that happened. Maybe, you know, there's David Copperfield is visiting and he set up some sort of trick or something like that. But normally when things happen, you know, we expect some sort of reason, some chain of causal events to bring them about to occur. But quantum physics really seems to be telling us that we go down to, again, we're talking at the atomic level, at the subatomic level, the world really is, in some sense, a casino, fundamentally random, although we can predict the statistics, the large numbers. And that things acausally, just spontaneously occur. And philosophers have debated over this for years and years. A whole PhD theses have been written on this. I'd just like to get you to kind of discuss that a bit now. And this actually brings in one teaching tool I got from a recent American Association of Physics Teachers conference that I had at. And here we have sort of three different views that might be held about. So I'll just present the technique the way it normally is. And we'll see how that goes. And so I was actually giving this talk to some people, some teachers last week. And so essentially this is, this is a technique for really helping to bring out in the open and expose and make explicit student ideas about a particular topic, and you can use it for any topic, and particular misconceptions that they have. So I was giving this talk to some teachers last week. And we're actually talking about this, and people actually turned out they had some different views about what was the correct way of looking at things. And there was David. And David said that, well, physics must be deterministic. It must be, you know, some reason as to why the radioactive atom occurs. And that's because it's impossible things to just happen for no reason whatsoever. There must be some sort of deeper, hidden, underlying cause that underlies why each electron goes through the slit that it does. We just haven't yet discovered it. Quantum physics is an intermediate theory, and there's some deeper and extra layer to nature. So that's one point of view. And Andrea as well. And she said, well, we must take quantum theory at face value. It's an incredibly accurate theory. And trust what it seems to be telling us. It's been proven by experiment after experiment. We'd accept that electrons just simply do go through each slit in a way that's fundamentally random. So that's point of view. And then there was Joanne. And she said, look, physics is just a collection of artificial models, a set of convenient fictions that we use. That's, we can never tell whether or not the world is really random and deterministic. Only philosophy or religion, so something outside of science, can answer that question. So what I'd like you to do now, so there's three different views. So what I'd like you to talk to the people around you and just decide which of those you believe or you find the most appealing or the closest to what you believe, come to some kind of consensus. And obviously there's no wrong answer to this. And then we might write down things on our whiteboards. Just write down whether you closely agree with David, Andrea, or Joanne. So 3 minutes. No, I said my team is not expecting anything. I said look at the team, it's up in the air. I'm pretty sure they'd have it. I know it could be white, but I didn't say you'll be running. Oh, well, actually, the director is coming from Green Lake at 4. And he was actually my great boss. Yeah. Okay. There's no right or wrong answer. Okay, there's a few people at the back. David. Okay, that's actually interesting. So thank you very much for that. Okay. So that was actually interesting, so you couldn't see that, but that was a very interesting spread. So probably I'd say about half the people had David. There are a large number of people had none of the above, that had some sort of hybrid of the names, more than names on the one. So that's interesting, so that gives me a good little snapshot of what you're thinking. So this is, so part of the reason I put that up, as I said, I got this from the American Association of Physics Teachers Conference. But this is something I like. It's really a teaching tool. Has anyone actually used something like this before in their class? Okay, yep. But this is something a lot of people use, and it doesn't have to be in modern physics. It can actually be anything. I just find it useful in the sense that if you're looking at some topic, it could be, let's say, Newton's first law, and you know students might have misconceptions about that, that they think that if there's no net force acting on an object, then its natural tendency is just to stop and come to rest. That rest is a natural state of motion. And you kind of want to actually bring that out and actually sort of bring it out in the open so you can confront it and really sort of talk about that and discuss why that's flawed and what the problems are with that. So I think something I used to do, a one very natural thing, is to, okay, try and kind of draw that out of the student, get the student to state that. But then that can be, you know, it can be very difficult because the students, they could be shy, or they might have just trouble articulating that. You make up these fake people. And you make up these fake people, David, so Joanne is not real, I have to say. So you make up these fake people, and... okay. Yeah, you make up these fake people, and then you give them the views. And one could be the right view, and two, what you want two to, or three to be, is just common misconceptions that you know from experience. There's a good chance that students are thinking this. So maybe I just happen to know that there's a large fraction of students that are thinking this in my class, and I really want to basically... maybe in this case not say they're wrong, but really get them just to be aware of what they're thinking, aware of the preconceptions and the strategy, the ideas that they hold, and just get them reflecting on that and getting them that there are some ideas. So, in a sense, yes?
What would you be looking for if you're, because we're teachers, and at the end of the day, everything comes down to assessment.
Right.
So how would anyone, I've got no idea how you'd go about assessing a response, a student response to someone. I don't know how, but other people, you know what I mean? Like,
right, right. Yeah, I mean, so obviously not every, yeah, I mean, that's true. So, I mean, I haven't heard of anyone actually using this as an assessment tool. Maybe you could be creative, you could think of some way, but...
I'd say it is an assessment tool. Assessment doesn't necessarily result... If you don't have to record a number to be an assessment, assessments can be used to improve learning, not necessarily
right.
to record a mark for it.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's true. So you can actually have one being the right answer and two being wrong answers. So in that sense, you can assess just how what level of student understanding is, whether students A, B, and C get it right, and which ones get it wrong. So Dave, did you have a...
Yeah, where it fits in nicely in Ontario right now is just a large literacy movement. So just the ability for them to have an opinion supported with supporting sentences, et cetera, in the traditional format that we're teaching. Mm-hmm. Assess it as communication, not whether
yep.
you're correct.
Yep.
Assess that for a different way, mm-hmm. just as a communication piece.
Yep.
In Ontario, it fits in very well right now because the literacy is huge.
Yep.
On our scale.
Okay, great, thanks, yeah. But this is, I mean, I find useful, just you can basically set up these, some of them as, with, say, the right opinion, and some other, basically as straw men or straw people that you can knock down or really question and show the fallacies in those views. So that's one teaching strategy. Okay, we come on to the last, number four, core feature of quantum physics, and this is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And what I'll actually be doing is, so Newtonian physics, so forget about quantum physics for a moment. If we have a speck of dust or any object in it, according to Isaac Newton, we can, in principle anyway, measure both where it is, down to, you know, the billionth decimal place, absolute precision, and also how fast it's moving, its velocity, again, down to the billionth decimal place, in theory anyway, and know exactly where it is, how fast it's moving, and so what its future trajectory will be. There's no fundamental limit to how much information you contain. And that seems like a very reasonable thing. Why would there? But that's actually not true in quantum physics. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it's some sort of strange, hardwired limit, fundamentally in nature, that stops you from simultaneously getting precise knowledge about these two things, both, I guess, the position and the momentum of one particular particle, an electron, a proton, and actually places limits. Roughly speaking, the more that you know about the position of a particle, the less, by some sort of measuring device, some sort of detector, the less you necessarily know about position, or the more you know about position, the less you necessarily know about its velocity or its momentum. And what I decided to do was a bit creative and actually tell this via sort of just a little narrative, a little story. Because often stories are things that people really sort of help to things to stick in minds, people's minds more. So let's consider a story of Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, trying to measure the position and velocity of an electron using a gamma ray microscope. And this is a well-known sort of thought experiment. So this is how he actually came up with his uncertainty principle. It was at least a large part of it back in 1927, it was. And so this is not a real microscope. It's some idealized, fictional microscope that was in his head. It's just kind of an odd tool he was looking at. And so he walked into his lab one day and set up his idealized microscope, because he was a theoretical physicist, so he could do that. And what it consisted of, essentially, is just a bare-bone skeleton one, and had the objective lens in. It's sort of circular, in the sense that actually sort of looking from it front on, sort of circular aperture it presents. And there was some electron. So he wants to find out both the position and the velocity of an electron. And then after the objective lens, we have the eyepiece. So essentially, you know, this is, we're just sort of stripping the microscope down to the fundamental elements. The objective lens that focuses the light, and also the eyepiece that helps to focus as well. So what do you do? You place a single electron in the viewing area and realize that to see it, if you want to see any object, you just shine some light on it. So it could not be done in perfect darkness down in the cave somewhere. So we had some light, just basically a light that actually arranged to go along the x-axis here. So plane wave, idealized plane wave of light coming along with a single frequency from the left here towards the electron. And as he was, Heisenberg was really intimately familiar with Einstein's boson hypothesis, the idea that you can think of light as consisting of individual packets or bundles of photons of energy. He knew that he could think of the light instead of as a wave, but actually as this kind of shower or stream of photons, tiny particle-like objects coming towards, impacting on the electron. He also knew that as he made sure the light was traveling in the x direction, only as momentum in the x direction, parallel to the x axis, each photon he could associate with a momentum, and momentum given by h divided by lambda. And h is, of course, Planck's constant, 6.63 by 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. And lambda is a photon's wavelength. So this is the picture he had in his mind. Of course, because he was good friends with Compton, Mr. Compton, he knew that as the photons collided with the electrons, so we have this sort of stream of photons here colliding, impact on the electrons. They basically do that in particle-particle-like collisions, like tiny hard spheres colliding with each other. That's one model you can have, as modeled by the Compton effect. And so while Heisenberg was fine-tuning his microscope, he suddenly thought, well, okay, if I want this to work, I have to have at least one photon, absolute minimum, must collide with the electron, bounce off, then go into my microscope, and what will happen is that will give me some information about where the electron is. If zero photons impact, I have no idea, nothing is going to my microscope, I cannot know where the position of the electron will be. We then began to visualize what would happen, basically this collision process, what would happen before and afterwards. Could the electron just sitting there, or although it could be actually moving itself, photon, this is a representation of it before, it impacts on, then the photon will recoil off, get scattered, will go in some direction here, and the photon also will be scattered as a result of the collision. And that will go, and with some of the photons will go and basically get scattered into the objective lens, and then they'll get moved on to the eyepiece, and we'll see them with our eye after the eyepiece. And that's actually how we see where the position of the electron is. And so this was a gamma ray microscope because, realistically, you need very, very, electrons are very small, so you actually need not visible light probably, but actually gamma rays are very, very, very incredibly high frequency, much higher than visible light, so much smaller wavelength, high frequency, smaller wavelength, and so basically have a lot better, finer resolution. So this is what we have for the gamma ray microscope. So what he realized that, it's a random thing. So he doesn't know exactly where the each photon is. He doesn't know exactly where the electron is. So he can't, basically it's not a repeatable process that every photon-electron collision, the electron gets recoiled in exactly the same direction and the photon goes off in the same direction. So there's this randomness because he doesn't know the initial conditions exactly where the two particles are. So you could get a photon that gets scattered off in this direction here, or one that gets scattered off in that direction there. So these are two extreme possibilities, basically any direction. And as long as the photons actually go and reach into the eyepiece, go into the objective lens, and then go into the eyepiece, he can't actually tell, looking at them, what angle they came in at, whether they came in at the extreme of here or they came in at the extreme of there. Because just looking through, looking into the eyepiece and looking through the end of the microscope that he does, that does not give any information. That doesn't tell him, okay, the photon was scattered, went along this path or that path. It just tells him where the photon is. It doesn't give any information about what was happening before. So there's some uncertainty, some lack of knowledge there about exactly what happened, the details of this this scattering event. So let's make the objective lens really, really wide. So just kind of widen this out here, make this sort of very, very wide. And in this case, what we do is we sort of widen the extreme angles that the photons could go, get scattered by, and actually still get into the objective lens. So I guess, So very very wide angles there. So in the limit, we actually have basically photons coming at any angle. I guess you can make that pi 180 degrees. So that's maybe not the most realistic case, but that's you can at least approach that anyway, in theoretically. And so given that's the case, there are two extremes. So what would happen for a photon to reach and go into the objective lens at that point, what you would have is would have to come in here, and that would be a head-on collision between the photon and the electron. So a head-on collision basically would have the photon recoil in some sort of direction like that, almost back. And so in that case, the photon would end up with a momentum of basically assuming it keeps its same frequency and wavelength. Basically, it would just hit and then bounce back the direction it came from. So it would have a momentum of h over lambda in the positive x direction. It bounces back at the same momentum in the opposite direction. So it has a momentum of minus h bar over lambda there. And the other extreme is just a glancing collision. So photon hits and it goes almost the same trajectory it was going. Basically, there's very, very minimal change to the momentum of the photon. So it goes into this extreme. Then what would happen, it would just keep on going with the same momentum that it had before. Px is h over lambda. So these are the two extremes. But again, you can't actually looking at through the lens or looking actually through the eyepiece, you cannot determine which of those two possibilities happened. You just see the light coming in. You don't. Yes.
What if the experiment ideally is done in a dark room and you shine laser light that's very well collimated, so mm-hmm. all the electrons come in exactly the same direction, and you only observe the scatter?
So, I mean, the direction, this is actually what he was assuming in this case. So they all come in the same direction. But even a laser light that's coherent, it does have some finite spot size. So, I mean, you can't actually get laser light. I mean, it will have some finite spot size. If you look, shine a laser pointer to that end of the room, I mean, that looks tiny. But actually, at the atomic level, that's massive. So even if they're going the same direction, just for it to be a physical laser, it must have some finite spot size, and if you have that, then you do actually have some uncertainty there. Also, you don't actually know where the electron is prior, so you have to have some finite spot size to get an idea of where you want to shine the laser beam. Okay, so these are the two extreme possibilities. These are the uncertain; it doesn't know whether that happened or that happened. And so he's basically has some uncertainty there. What a quick mental calculation, Heisenberg realized that these basically in these two cases, when the electron or the photon bounced back, that gave the so just by conservation of momentum, the change in the momentum of the electron initially was going plus h divided by lambda, and now we have minus h divided by lambda. The difference between those is 2h divided by lambda. And so in that case, the electron got an extra momentum kick in the x direction of plus 2h bar divided by lambda. And so that's the final momentum of it, the initial plus that. And the final one is just a glancing blow, very little impact. So it actually had the same momentum at the end that it started with. So the final momentum is there. So these are the two extreme possibilities. Heisenberg could not distinguish between the two just looking through the eyepiece. And so he doesn't know which of those two possibilities happen or any way in between. So as a result, his uncertainty, just the lack of knowledge about what the momentum is of the electron, could be anywhere between these two extremes here. And if you look at that as an interval and just take the, I guess, the difference between those two extremes, and then to get the uncertainty, just halve that, you have 2h bar divided by lambda minus 0, and that gives you h divided by lambda. And so that's actually a measure just because of this uncertainty really in the scattering process, which way the electron was flung or scattered off or recoiled off, which direction it was. that means that Heisenberg, or just initially, had this lack of knowledge. He didn't know what the final momentum of the electron was. It could have been anywhere within this sort of broad range. And so that gives you uncertainty of the momentum of the electron. So that's the electron in the x direction. And so that's fundamentally, he does not know if any more than that, more accurately than that. That's the uncertainty in the momentum. And so as he looked out his lab window at the university, some students going around, he realized and he reflected on the fact that at the quantum level, measurement is just a very messy, disruptive process. And that when you're dealing with, if you're trying to measure an atom and electron, whatever you measure with, will at least at the smallest will be another atom or another electron. And so what you're trying to measure, the measuring device is going to be at least as sort of big as or larger than what you're actually trying to measure. So actually, at the quantum level, it will necessarily disrupt it, or in some unavoidable way. So that's that. So that's momentum. Okay. Actually, what we might okay. So there are two ways that we can actually minimize the electrons and certainly the momentum. Heisenberg thought. What we can do, obviously, just have less photons, have less collisions, less scattering events. So just decrease and ramp down the number of photons in the incident light. And ideally, just decrease it just to one photon. So one collision between an electron and a photon. That's going to cause a minimum amount. Any more, you just increase the uncertainty, multiplies. But also, remember there was a wavelength in there. So the uncertainty momentum was inversely proportional to the wavelength. So if we make the wavelength really, really big, we have very long wavelength light, then what we'll do is actually we'll decrease the uncertainty momentum. Longer wavelength light corresponds to a lower frequency, so it's less energetic light. So maybe we're getting microwaves, radio waves, they're longer wavelength light. But what will happen, we'll see, is the longer you make the wavelength of the light, the less you kind of disturb the collision because each photon has less energy. But unfortunately, what happens is you actually necessarily, that means you actually get less information about position. You're more uncertain about the position of the electron. So there's this basically a trade-off. So you want the long wavelength light to basically have very, very gentle collisions so you don't disrupt the momentum by very much. But if you're a long wavelength light, that basically leads to more diffraction, the spreading out of the light. And the spreading out, the more that light spreads out, the less you have an idea of where the actual electron is. So that increases the uncertainty in the position when you're actually looking through the eyepiece. And so you find out there's this fundamental limit and a trade-off. And we'll see in a minute Heisenberg's uncertainty principle quantifies that. And so thinking about the position, turning on the position of the electron, Heisenberg knew from his undergraduate days, as far as we know, electrons are point particles, they're just little dots. But he also recalled from Optics 101 that we do not see them or any other objects as particle-like dots in a microscope. And that is basically due to diffraction. So rather, assuming there was, we have a circular aperture that the microscope presents, so we look at it sort of from below, it looks like it has a circular shape. Then, and we have a large number of electrons incident on it, so we actually see it as a smeared out circle with actually a series of rings due to the diffraction of the light as it travels from the objective lens to the eyepiece. So if you have, let me see. So if you had some kind of circular aperture and a point source of some sort of object here, a point-like object, then light gets reflected off it, then it actually, and it comes through this some sort of, you have a screen here. With aperture, a hole, then you actually don't see what happens. It gets to this aperture, and then the light, essentially, it's like going through a vertical slit. What happens is it actually diffracts, it spreads out as well. So the light. spreads out. And so if you look, so it's hard to get the perspective right, but if you actually look at what you see in the final screen, if you actually get a focused image, it's actually basically it's a spread out disk, and it has sort of or a series of rings known as an airy disk. And that's actually, again, it's a diffraction effect. Light goes through this aperture, it goes through this this circular hole, and then what happens, it just spreads out. It diffracts, wave-like property of light. And if you actually figure out the minimum, the smallest you can get, the diameter of this, the disk to be, basically speaking, is going to be of the order of the wavelength of light. That the bigger the wavelength, the more the diffraction is, and you can actually get a disk, depending on how you actually set up the configuration, larger than that, but basically the smallest. So it's a theoretical experiment. We're trying to find the smallest amount of diffraction, the least, the smallest airy disk that we have. That's actually at least going to be the order of the wavelength, because the more, the greater the wavelength, the larger it is, the more diffraction you have. And so you can't beat the diffraction. You can't stop light from diffracting. And whatever, and if you have a large number of photons, you get this disk built up, basically impacting on your electron. And the electron or whatever the object you're looking at, the point source, that'll actually be located at the center of the disk. So you have this point object gets represented, or the image is of a disk, but right in the middle, you know that's where the object is, the center of the pattern. But what we did, we don't want to shine, you know, a billion photons onto the electron. Because if we do that, then what's going to happen is we'll just knock it every which way and we'll have no idea what its momentum is. We have this massive uncertainty momentum. So we want to minimize things. So we get down to one photon. If we have one photon that's just impacting there onto the electron, then what we have is that we don't end up getting a disk, because this is a pattern we build up. This is made up of many, 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 many photons impacting and colliding onto this central point here. What we actually have is and if you build up that airy disk sort of photon by photon, that's millions of photons. Each individual point where the photons is actually at a random location somewhere within this disk here, this sort of central area. And there's actually no correlation necessarily between where the object is, where the electron is, or the point particle, and where each actual photon hits within this disk here. And there's no strict correlation between them. So basically, if you have one photon, you just have one photon that collides with the electron, that basically gets into the microscope, into the objective, then kind of diffracts out. And then you'll actually get it hitting at some sort of random point within this circle here. And so if you find out where the photon hits in the eyepiece, or where you actually register looking for the eyepiece, where the photon hits, you can't tell where the center of this disk is to within the order of roughly about, or a rough estimate of just what your uncertainty is of the center of the airy disk, or the center of this pattern. It's round about the order of a wavelength. Because if you get a dot there, that could be the center, or it could be over there, it could be there. And just the distance or measure, roughly seeing the patterns of the diameter of a wavelength, you know that at the very worst, the worst case scenario, you're within round about a wavelength of the actual true position of the electron. So that gives you just a measure of just how uncertain you are of the position of the electron due to one photon hitting. It might not be exactly correlated with where the electron is. So that gives you some sort of measure. Since this is a rough estimate of just where the electron, how uncertain you are, what information you lack about where the electron is. And that's round about delta x equals lambda. So we put it together, what we have delta p equals h divided by lambda, and then delta x equals lambda, and then the lambdas cancel out, and we're just left with h. And so what we have is that's the minimum value. Again, looking at an idealized case, how low can we get? If we idealize, optimize everything, there's this sort of flaw. Just due to the uncertainty in the collision and the direction that each photon gets scattered into the microscope gives us an uncertainty in the momentum of the electron. And also just the diffraction spreading out of light, that gives us an uncertainty in the position of the electron. And we tried to minimize both as much as we could. Now what we see at the very least, their H Planck's constant, 6.63 by 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds, which in everyday units is tiny. So if you know you're doing an experiment, obviously we don't fundamentally reach this experiment. We're doing something with a tabletop experiment with our students. But that's the minimum. And of course, if you don't idealize everything and try as best you can to minimize that, you can get much larger than that. And so that's how we arrive at Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Delta X modified by delta P equals, or is greater than or equal to H. And so that is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And you can actually do a more detailed argument if you follow all the factors of 2 and the factors of pi and so forth. And what you actually get is delta X multiplied by delta P equals H bar divided by 2. Or H bar is H divided by 2 pi. But essentially that just changes things by, a factor of 4 pi. So it's 4 pi is, so it's about 12. So 12, you know, it's really not much in the sense that it's dominated by this H. So we actually had the H there. But what interesting point philosophically about it is that it's very natural to think, well, you know, Heisenberg was a bad experimenter. Maybe we could design a better experiment. We could get a laser beam, or we could have something a lot fancier, and you could actually beat that limit. You know, this was a very primitive experiment. You're just talking about something with that looked like that. It just had an objective lens. It had an eyepiece. Maybe, you know, surely they had more sophisticated equipment around than that. If you had super precise optics and electric fields and who knows what they have these days, you could actually measure delta X and delta P to beat the Heisenberg uncertainty limit. And what quantum physics tells you mathematically, without even seeing the details of any experiment, is actually impossible. It's this fundamental limit. And so that's why I think I mentioned yesterday, as soon as physicists get in their sort of inbox an email saying, you know, I've beaten Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and this is an experiment where you can measure delta X and delta P that beats Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, they basically just hit the belief button, because it's just from the mathematics of fundamental principles, it stops you from doing that. It's nothing to do with scientists being sort of bad or us just making mistakes with the experiments. It really is just the way nature is set up, just the way the game is set up. You cannot do that. Okay. And one interesting point, so as it's an equality, so delta X and delta P can be as large as you like. They, you know, can both be up basically infinitely large. So it doesn't always have to be that the product of the two uncertainties is actually equal to H, but it's only there are many, many states, many, many examples where you know a lot less about the position, and there are many experiments about the position and momentum of a particle. And generally you do, because it's very, very hard to get down to that limit. And only a small number of states and a small number of experiments can actually get anywhere close to actually getting to be an equality delta X multiplied by delta P equals H. Okay. So as I mentioned before, this actually has an application. So it seems like, since a lot of scientists thought of it as it's a negative thing, that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is something that stops you from getting a hold of nature, knowing as much about nature as you ought to be able to, sort of this a roadblock or a limit that, you know, quantum mechanics is stopping you from sort of extracting nature about the position and the momentum of an electron. But actually you can kind of flip that around and use it to your advantage, and that is quantum cryptography. And so this is actually a commercial reality. So you can buy quantum cryptographic schemes for $50,000 US. And so if you're interested in purchasing one, there's a website there. Just log on to that. And what if you want to actually set up a secret code, or one way of doing that is to actually between... So, for example, say you want to keep your credit card number secure, and basically your bank account, you might want to transmit over the internet, either of those two numbers. Obviously, you don't want anyone to be snooping or hacking into your credit card number or your bank account number. And so one way of doing that is to actually set up between you and the receiver some kind of stream or collection or secret string of numbers. And typically their binary numbers are 01010110, this huge long stream that only you know and the receiver knows. And if you can set up that, that's called a cryptographic key, then you can actually use that, that sort of secret information, to basically sort of encrypt or make your credit card number secret. And that's actually what is actually used, some scheme that uses that, when you actually book a concert ticket or a holiday or a flight, something like that, on the internet. There's one particular scheme that does that. And so what they do, one type of quantum cryptography is you can actually, in a sense, hide the information about a... you're trying to send or hide something either in the position or the momentum of the particle. So in a sense, you kind of correlate where the particle is with some sort of number. So so if you want to sort of transmit a number 1 or a number 0, you could give the particle, say, if you want to transmit the number 1, you could give the particle a positive position, the number 0 a negative position. So somehow you can extract, you can measure the position of the particle and find out that secret number you're trying to find. You can do a similar thing with momentum. And so you've kind of got this information hidden away, the momentum or the position of your particle. And it turns out that, okay, let's say someone tries to, you're sending an electron down a wire or whatever, and someone's trying to snoop on that. Someone's trying to eavesdrop and actually find out what your the information that you've hidden there is. So basically, because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, is credible sensitivity of the particle. And if you make sure that the person doesn't know whether the information is hidden in the momentum or the position, you can arrange things so that maybe randomly you hide the information in the position or the momentum, then what happens is that they actually don't know which of those two things is the momentum. And so if they measure the wrong one, they measure the position, then they'll immediately sort of disrupt or mess up or in some way know very little information about what the momentum of the particle is. And that will actually disrupt the momentum in a very noticeable way. It will disturb it that someone else at the other end can tell. And so what essentially it is, again, you'll see more about this at the Institute for Quantum Computing, but it's really Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells you if you measure the position of a particle, you necessarily disrupt its momentum. You know less information about it. You have to collide a particle off, and that changes it. And so just that very change is something that the other end of the cryptographic scheme, the receiver, they can actually pick that up. They can actually notice, okay, you know, someone's disturbed the momentum. And so any attempt to eavesdrop by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle at the quantum level with his quantum secret codes necessarily messes them up or disturbs them. It really leaves a trace. So it's impossible to snoop on particles using these quantum codes without leaving a trace. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle guarantees that. And so in theory, these codes, the reason why people are excited about them, in theory and principle, they're 100% secure. Okay, so what we might do is, okay. So we've got a break in about 40 minutes. So I thought we might play a game now. So kind of.